E.T., or V? Some of you may not want to find out. According to John Lear, inventor of the Learjet, once you know, your life is an even greater danger. And they know who knows. John knew. He created the Learjet, flew hundreds of planes, and had sensitive military contacts. But John died after uploading the testimony on a computer network called Paranet. For a brief period of time, users nationwide could download his story. But at the risk, their lines would be traced and they, too, visited in the night. Just by hearing the following testimony, you may also be putting yourself at great risk. If they have the technology to arrive at Earth, they can certainly find out who's listening to this station. So find out, then, at your own risk, the horrible truth as John Lear stated it before his death.
The horrible truth the government has been hiding from us for over 40 years. Unfortunately, the horrible truth is far more horrible than the government ever imagined. In the effort to protect democracy, our government sold us to the aliens, and here is how it happened. But before I begin, I'd like to offer a word in the defense of those who bargained us away. They had the best of intentions. Germany may have recovered a flying saucer as early as 1939. General James H. Doolittle went to Sweden in 1946 to inspect the flying saucer that had crashed there in Spitsbergen. The horrible truth was known by only very few persons. They were indeed ugly little creatures, shaped like praying mantises, and who were more advanced than us by perhaps a billion years. Of the original group that there were the first to learn the horrible truth, several committed suicide, the most prominent of which was General James V. Forrestal, who jumped to his death from a 16-story hospital window. General Forrestal's medical records are sealed to this day. President Truman quickly put a lid on the secret and turned the screws so tight that the general public still thinks that flying saucers are a joke. Have I ever got a surprise for them? In 1947, President Truman established a group of 12 of the top military scientific personnel of their time. They were known as MJ-12. Although the group exists today, none of the original members are still alive. The last one to die was Gordon Gray, former Secretary of the Army, in 1984. As each member passed away, the group itself appointed a new member to fill the position. There is some speculation that the group known as MJ-12 expanded to at least several more members. There were several more saucer crashes in the late 1940s, one in Roswell, New Mexico, one in Aztec, New Mexico, and one near Laredo, Texas, about 30 miles inside the Mexican border. Consider, if you will, the position of the United States government at that time. They proudly thought of themselves as the most powerful nation on Earth, having recently produced the atomic bomb, an achievement so stupendous it would take Russia 4 years to catch up, and only with the help of traitors to democracy. They had built a jet aircraft that had exceeded the speed of sound in flight. They had built jet bombers with intercontinental range that could carry weapons of enormous destruction. The post-war era and the future seemed bright. Now imagine what it was like for those same leaders, all of whom had witnessed the panic of Orson Welles' radio broadcast, The War of the Worlds, in 1938. Thousands of Americans panicked at a realistically presented invasion of Earth by beings from another planet. Imagine their horror as they actually viewed the dead bodies of these frightening-looking little creatures with enormous eyes, reptilian skin, and claw-like fingers. Imagine their shock as they attempted to determine how these strange saucers were powered and could discover no part even remotely similar to components they were familiar with. No cylinders or pistons, no vacuum tubes or turbines or hydraulic actuators. It is only when you fully understand the overwhelming helplessness the government was faced with in the late 40s that you can comprehend their perceived need for a total, thorough, and sweeping cover-up to include the use of deadly force. The cover-up was so successful that as late as 1985, a senior scientist with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, Dr. Al Hibbs, would look at a videotape of an enormous flying saucer and state the record, "I'm not going to assign anything to that phenomena without a lot more data." Dr. Hibbs was looking at the naked emperor and saying, "He certainly looks naked, but that doesn't prove he's naked." In July of 1952, a panicked government watched helplessly a squadron of flying saucers flew over Washington, D.C. and buzzed the White House, the Capitol building, and the Pentagon. It took all the imagination and intimidation the government could muster to force that incident out of the memory of the public. Thousands of sightings occurred during the Korean War, and several more saucers were retrieved by the Air Force. Some were stored at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Some were stored at Air Force bases near the location of the crash site. One saucer was so enormous, and the logistic problems and transportation so enormous, that it was buried at the crash site and remains there today. The stories are legendary on transporting crash saucers over long distances, moving only at night, purchasing complete farms, slashing through forests, blocking major highways, sometimes driving two and three lowboys in tandem with the extraterrestrial load 100 feet in diameter. On April 30, 1964, the first communication between these aliens and the U.S. government took place at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. Three saucers landed at a prearranged area, and a meeting was held between the aliens and intelligence officers of the U.S. government. During the period of 1969 to 1971, MJ-12, representing the U.S. government, made a deal with these creatures called EBEs, Extraterrestrial Biological Entities, named by Det Lebrock, original MJ-12 member and sixth president of Johns Hopkins University. The deal was that in exchange for technology that they would provide to us, we agreed to ignore the abductions that were going on and suppress information on the cattle mutilations. The EBEs assured MJ-12 that abductions, usually lasting about 2 hours, were merely the ongoing monitoring of developing civilizations. In fact, the purposes for the abductions turned out to be, 1, the insertion of a 3-millimeter spherical device through the nasal cavity of the abductee into the brain. The device is used for biological monitoring, tracking, and control of the abductee. Implementation of post-hypnotic suggestion to carry out a specific activity during a specific time period, the actuation of which occur within the next 2 to 5 years. 3, termination of some people so that they could function as living sources for biological material and substances. 4, termination of individuals who represent a threat to the continuation of their activity. 5, effect genetic engineering experiments. 6, impregnation of human females and early termination of pregnancies to secure the crossbreed infant. The U.S. government was not initially aware of the far-reaching consequences of their deal. They were led to believe that the abductions were essentially benign, and since they figured out abductions would probably go on anyway, whether they agreed or not, they merely insisted that a current list of abductees be submitted on a periodic basis to MJ-12 and the National Security Council. Does this sound incredible? An actual list of abductees sent to the National Security Council? Read on, because I have news for you. The EBEs have a genetic disorder in that their digestive system is atrophied and not functional. Some speculate that they were involved in some type of accident or nuclear war, possibly on the backside of an evolutionary genetic curve. In order to sustain themselves, they use an enzyme or hormonal secretion obtained from the tissue that they extract from humans and animals. Note, cows and humans are genetically similar. In the event of a national disaster, cow's blood can be used by humans. The secretions obtained are then mixed with hydrogen peroxide and applied on the skin by spreading or dipping parts of their bodies in the solution. The body absorbs the solution and excretes the waste back through the skin. The cattle mutilations that were prevalent throughout the period from 1973 to 1983 and publicly noted through newspaper and magazine stories and included a documentary produced by Linda Howe for the Denver CBS affiliate KMGH-TV were for the collection of these tissues by the aliens. The mutilations included genitals taking, rectums cored out to the colon, eyes, tongue, and throat, all surgically removed with extreme precision. In some cases, the incisions were made by cutting between the cells, a process we are not yet capable of performing in the field. In many of the mutilations, there was no blood found at all in the carcass, yet there was no vascular collapse of the internal organs. This has been also noted in human mutilations, one of the first of which was Sergeant Jonathan P. Louette at the White House Sands Missile Test Range in 1956, who was found 3 days after an Air Force major had witnessed his abduction by a disc-shaped object at 0300 while on a search for missile debris downrange. His genitals had been removed, rectum cored out in a surgically precise plug up to the colon, eyes removed, and all blood removed with, again, no vascular collapse. From some of the evidence, it is apparent that this surgery is accomplished, in most cases, while the victim, animal, or human is still alive. The various parts of the body are taken to various underground laboratories, one of which is known to be near the small New Mexico town of Dulce. This jointly occupied CIA alien facility has been described as enormous, with huge tiled walls that go on forever. Witnesses have reported huge vats filled with amber liquid with parts of human bodies being stirred inside. After the initial agreement, Groom Lake, one of this nation's most secret test centers, was closed for a period of about a year, sometime between about 1972 and 1974, and a huge underground facility was constructed for and with the help of the EBEs. The bargain for technology was set in place but could only be operated by the EBEs themselves. Needless to say, the advanced technology could not be used against the EBEs themselves, even if needed. During the period between 1979 and 1983, it became increasingly obvious to MJ-12 that things were not going as planned. It became known that many more people in the thousands were being abducted than were listed in the official abduction list. In addition, it became obvious that some, not all, but some of the nation's missing children had been used for secretions and other parts required by the aliens. In 1979, there was an altercation of sorts at the Dulles Laboratory. Our special armed forces unit was called in to try to free a number of our people trapped in the facility who had become aware of what was really going on. According to one source, 66 of the soldiers were killed and our people were not freed. By 1984, MJ-12 must have been in the stark terror at the mistake they had made in dealing with the EBEs. They had subtly promoted Close Encounters of the Third Kind and ET to get the public used to odd-looking aliens that were compassionate, benevolent, and very much our space brothers. MJ-12 sold the EBEs to the public, and were now faced with the fact that quite the opposite was true. In addition, a plan was formulated in 1968 to make the public aware of the existence of aliens on Earth over the next 20 years, to be culminated with several documentaries to be released during 1985 to 1987 period of time. These documentaries would explain the history and intentions of the EBEs. The discovery of the grand deception put the entire plans, hopes, and dreams of MJ-12 into utter confusion and panic. Meeting at the country club, a remote lodge with private golf course, comfortable sleeping and working quarters, and its own private airstrip built by and exclusively for the members of MJ-12, it was a fractional fight of what to do now. Part of the MJ-12 wanted to confess the whole scheme and shambles it had supported to the public, beg their forgiveness, and ask for their support. The other part and majority of MJ-12 argued that there was no way they could do that, that the situation was untenable and there was no use in exciting the public with the horrible truth, and that the best plan was to continue the development of a secret weapon that could be used against EBEs under the guise of SDI. The Strategic Defense Initiative, which had nothing whatsoever to do with a defense for inbound Russian nuclear missiles. As these words are being written, Dr. Edwin Teller, father of the H-bomb, is personally in the test tunnels of Nevada test site, driving his workers and associates, in the words of one, like a man possessed, as well he should, for Dr. Teller is a member of MJ-12, along with Dr. Kissinger, Admiral Bobby Inman, and possibly Admiral Poindexter, to name a few of the current members of MJ-12. Now, you ask, why haven't I heard about any of this? Who do you think you would hear it from? Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Sam Donaldson? Wrong. These people just read the news. They don't find it. They have ladies who call and interview witnesses and verify statements on stories coming over the wire. It's not like Dan Rather would go down to Wytheville, Virginia, and dig into why there were 4,000 reported sightings in October and November of 87. Better that Tom Brokaw or someone else should risk their credibility on this type of story. Tom Brokaw? Tom wants Sam Donaldson to risk his credibility. No one is going to risk their neck on such outlandish ideas, regardless of how many people report sightings of 900-foot objects running them off the road. In the case of Wytheville sightings, dozens of vans with NASA letters on the side failed to interest newsmen, and those that asked questions were informed that NASA was doing a weather survey. If the government won't tell us the truth, and the major networks won't even give it serious consideration, then what is the big picture anyway? Are the EBEs, having done 100,000 or more abductions, possibly millions worldwide, built an untold number of secret underground bases, Groom Lake, Nevada, Sunspot, Daytale, Roswell, and Pinetown, New Mexico, just to name a few, getting ready to return to wherever they came from, or from the obvious preparations, are we to assume that they are getting ready for a big move? Or is the more sinister and most probable situation that the invasion is essentially complete and it is all over but the screaming? A well-planned invasion of Earth for its resources and benefits would not begin with mass landings of ray-gun-equipped aliens. A properly planned and executed invasion by a civilization thousands and probably hundreds of thousands of years in advance of us would most likely be complete before even a handful of people, say 12, realized what was happening. No fuss, no muss. The best advice I can give you is this. Next time you see a flying saucer and are awed by its obvious display of technology and gorgeous lights of pure color, run like hell.
So, are you laughing? Think it sounds like a bunch of unbelievable baloney? Unbelievable, perhaps. Baloney, perhaps not. John Lear can't prove anything now. It's just his established name and reputation that live on. So laugh, if you will. We'll see who's nuts when they float by in those liquid-filled vats deep underground in New Mexico. One thing's for certain. The statistics alone indicate other planets with life do exist. And the older ones could dwarf our civilization technologically. Our fate would be theirs to decide. Have they found us? Nay, are they still here? We may never know until it's too late. But even the most skeptical amongst us should heed the following warning. Watch the skies!